Welcome to the Living Love Podcast, a home for conversation with good people doing good work who are not famous yet. My name is Beth Tenner. I'm a facilitator, and over several decades, I've worked with incredible people in nonprofits, business, government, and communities as they collaborate to navigate challenges. We need stories of how to create relationships, workplaces, and communities that bring out the best in people and change destructive patterns. Here, we shine a light on the people who illustrate what is possible. We draw out what they have learned from experience. This podcast is part of Kinship, a hub for people committed to amplifying the power of healthy community. For those ready to live in a way that generates more love and connection rather than more fear and separation, welcome to the conversation. I'm so glad you're here. Welcome to the Living Love Podcast. My name is Beth Tenner. Today, I look forward to sharing with you this conversation with Libby Hoffman, who's the founder of a private foundation called Catalyst for Peace. And she's someone who worked most of her career in the fields of peace and development internationally. And one big part of her work was in Sierra Leone with a human rights activist named John Cocker. And working in partnership, she supported him in his vision of founding an organization called Fumble Talk, which in Sierra Leone means family talk, sitting down and having frank talk about what matters. The two of them had a vision of working for change in a different way, and they called it Inside Out. And so just a quick explanation of what this might look like and something we can relate to. If you think of a classroom teacher where they're trying to do their job and they get all these mandates and requirements flowing down from the school board, from the principal, the federal government, whatever it might be, and often they don't really get a say in what they think would work best. And this happens in workplaces to people on the front lines, the nurses, the frontline supervisors. It happens in communities, particularly those labeled as marginalized or low-income communities. They might have years of nonprofit and government programs flowing in, grants, people coming and going, and the residents themselves, even though they have ideas and agency and know what's needed, don't get asked, and they don't really get the capacity and the investment to be able to make their own decisions. And what we overlook is also we don't have places for them to work together on behalf of the whole community. So Inside Out is about focusing on the people themselves and saying they have the answers, and those coming in from the outside trying to, quote, help, are there supporting and growing that local leadership. So when we don't do that, we see the pattern of one thing after another and people getting demoralized and resistant to change. So what Libby and John did in Sierra Leone, this small country in West Africa, was they held this vision of being able to put people at the center and support them in building the structures and the processes to make good decisions together and rebuild the health of the community. So I think we need this lesson at all levels. You can call it inclusive governance and participation. And we're not talking a 1 or 2 year project. Libby and John have worked together for 15 years. In this ongoing way of supporting leadership and building the capacity for the people in different levels of the community in the country to make good collective decisions. So when I met Libby through a mutual friend and heard about what they've been doing in Sierra Leone, I was just so excited by it because I know we all say we need this, but we don't have many good models of what it looks like. I had the chance to travel there, as you'll hear about, and see as part of a learning gathering they did and go to some of the villages and meet the people from that country and see what they've done. And it's remarkable. And it's grown from what we talked about last episode with Charles Gibbs, talked about the Sierra Leone phrase of small, small, small. They started in one community with a healing bonfire after the Civil War. And that worked, and they started another one and another one, to the point they did 250 of these community reconciliation bonfires across the country. You'll also hear Libby talk about the Peace Mothers and that wonderful way of bringing women together and giving them a place to connect and build their leadership and make good decisions on behalf of the community and build projects. Those Peace Mothers groups have also now grown to several hundred across the country. So it's a remarkable story. And Libby has a book called The Answers Are There, which has a lot of the story in it. And I really encourage you to read it. In today's episode, we only talk about the first part of the story, and there's a lot more to it. Now, one other note I want to bring in before we move to the conversation with Libby is to pull back and see this story within the larger story it's a part of. So we have John from Sierra Leone, which is a country of the 50 or so countries in Africa. It's in West Africa. And in its lineage, long, of course, indigenous traditions there, which they somewhat reclaimed with Fumble Talk. But that country was part of the slave trade. The colonizing powers of Europe obviously came into those communities and did tremendous harm. And then dealing with a really hard civil war, which you can see as a consequence of so many years of oppression and traumas. So he's a man from Sierra Leone working with a white woman in America who's got wealth and privilege. And in the American part of the story, like same patterns here of a lot of enslavement and things. So Libby's someone who inherited wealth, and here she was saying, how can I use my wealth and my resource and my position for good? And so as we talk about racism and social injustice and these historic traumas and patterns, and all of us in the generation on the back end of these traumas in societies that are so unequal and such disparity of resources, to me, what Libby and John did, finding a way to work in partnership over 15 years to heal the wounds of war and rebuild community using the wealth and privilege that Libby could provide in partnership with activating and restoring the health and well-being of communities in this other country across the ocean, I think itself is also the imprint of a story and a way of working for those wanting to do good work and heal our communities and heal these long historic trauma patterns we've all inherited. This is a beautiful story. So again, her books, The Answers Are There. Read that. And I'm really excited for you to meet Libby today and hear this conversation.
I run a foundation called Catalyst for Peace, and our focus has been to try to create the space where the people most impacted by the war get to be the ones who lead in the rebuilding after the war. And about 15 years ago, I met a Sierra Leonean human rights advocate named John Cocker, who had been leading calls for human rights during the 11-year civil war in his country of Sierra Leone, and leading efforts to end the war and then to build a just peace process in his country. And when we met, Sierra Leone, that had been devastated by this 11-year civil war, they had had a special court, a tribunal that had prosecuted 13 men at the cost of $500 million. And they had had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission modeled after South Africa's in part, but the people most impacted by the war weren't able to participate in either one of those, and in fact, didn't feel impacted by them. And so you had people living next door to somebody who might have amputated their arm or killed their mother or forced them to harm a family member or burned down their house or a community center. And they had never talked about what happened. And so it was a recipe for the country simply couldn't move forward without addressing some of those. And John knew it. And he had a vision for a process that instead of being modeled after international justice mechanisms would draw from Sierra Leone's culture and tradition. And he wanted to have a process of truth-telling and apology and forgiveness that draws on Sierra Leone culture of family talk, fumble talk in Creole, which is this process of solving problems through conversation, oftentimes around a bonfire. And he and I met around our common commitment to find a space to create a space together where the people most impacted by war could be the ones who get to lead in doing that work. So we came together to build a process and ultimately an organization that would be designed to do that, to center a justice and reconciliation process in Sierra Leonean culture and tradition, and to create the space where the people most impacted by the war could be the ones to lead in the process. My first visit to Sierra Leone, was in March of 2008. John and I started working together in 2007. And the leading up to this process of the heart of the Fumble Talk process was bonfire ceremonies at the village level, where people would come together and tell the stories in front of their community of what they had done during the war or what had happened to them. And if the person who had done that was there, they would come forward and acknowledge what they had done and apologize, and there would be an opportunity to forgive. These bonfire ceremonies, though, took several months of work to plan, and that consultative process was also the heart of the Fumble Talk process. And that's what I want to tell a little bit of a story about.
Yeah, and before we get into that story, Libby, I'd love to just to translate this to those listeners, many of which might be living in America. Part of what I think is so powerful in the way that you and John approached all of this work was this same idea of creating a space for something that was needed, right? That they needed reconciliation at the local level after the war, which in this country, we can look at a lot of things broken or where there's been harms done, and we haven't found a way to come together and move forward so that we can come together as one. And so I think as people listen, I think thinking about it in that way, with its applicability of not only those affected by the war, but those on the front lines of teaching or being a nurse or, you know, the people in communities centering those closest to the work, we could also say having a voice and a process and a space to be taking leadership on what's needed. I just want to make that bridge to the applicability.
Another parallel dynamic that I think has a lot of resonance in domestic contexts also is that the people most impacted by the war, they didn't, as you were saying, they didn't have a voice, but their ideas of what justice would look like or what reconciliation looked like weren't even invited. Like, they didn't have any space where it was assumed that they might have an understanding of what justice would look like for them, or a space where they would be asked, what do you think it would look like and how would we go about doing it? And so the fundamental impulse behind the Fumble Talk process as a whole was to look for the resources, even in the places most decimated by war or by the legacies of colonialism, by the legacies of corruption, by the legacies of all of these forces that have been at work in that region for so long. Even in those places, they have resources, cultural, individual, and physical, to address the problems that they face and to step into their own leadership. And so that fundamental impulse, and what happens when you ask people what they want and how they want to achieve it, that fundamental impulse was core behind the work that we were committed to. And just as an example of that, so the way Fumble Talk worked, they would go into a region, and before they started working there, they'd bring together all of the leaders representing all the different groups, so victims and perpetrators from the war, elders and young people, Muslims and Christians, men and women, and ask them what they wanted to do. Did they want to reconcile? And if they wanted to reconcile, how did they want to do it? What resources did they already have in their community? And what help might they need from others to move forward with that? That's the fundamental framework that Fumble Talk took into the communities before it started working there. And as I say it, it sounds simple, but the reality of it is that it was so fundamentally new to people in that context, so fundamentally different. And one example, on my first visit to Sierra Leone, which was in March of 2008, I went over, John and I had already been working together for a few months, and they had been preparing the ground for the first of these bonfire ceremonies that were going to be the hallmark of the Fumble Talk process. And I went over for the first ceremony. And as they were preparing for that, they were getting ready to enter and start working in another community, a community named Manoa. And so I accompanied the staff as they went to do the consultation in that community before they started working together. And they brought together all these leaders sitting around the community center, which was an open air community center. They call it a court barray, and just asking people, did they want to reconcile? How did they want to do it? What resources did they have? What help might they need from the outside? And there was such a lively conversation that was sparked by that. First of all, the energy. People came together at first subdued because they had assumed that reconciliation just wasn't possible. Here it was at that point, 7 years after the war, and they hadn't had any kind of a reconciliation process. They were assuming that it wasn't possible. And yet, the question of being invited to ask if they wanted to, and how, it awakened in their thought this possibility, and there was lively conversation about it. And then what resources did they have? Well, then that awakened to them, oh, we have all of these, and look, we have this tradition, and it's been dormant since the war, but we want to reawaken it. Anyway, the conversation and the energy level just, it was palpable. And after an hour or so of this conversation, a gentleman who had been sitting on the edges stood up, and he was this tall gentleman dressed all in white. And he stood up and he had kind of the air of a school teacher. And he said, "You are the first people to ever come here and ask us what we want." And he recited this litany. He said, "First, the Christians came and they told us, no, your culture is bad. You need Christianity. And then the Muslims came and they said, no, 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 that's haram. You need Islam. And then the British came and they said, no, 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 your culture is backward. You need our civilization. And then the war came and that destroyed everything anyway. And then the aid organizations came."
Another in a long series.
And he said, "You were the first people to come here and ask us what we want, and to see our culture as a resource." And I was stunned when he said that. And it had matched everything that I was hearing. But both the rarity of it shocked me and the power that it unleashed to go into a community and see the potential that's there, see the resources that are there, see the people not just as victims, but as leaders and as leaders of their own process. The power in that invitation unleashes incredible energy to work together on your behalf.
So I had a chance to, Libby invited me and about 100 other people to travel to Sierra Leone. It was about 12 years into their work, and we're going to unfold where it went after this bonfire phase. So we had this global learning week there where we got to meet all of the people from the villages all the way up to senior parts of the Sierra Leone government who had been touched by where this sparking activation went. And I can speak to how alive and activated people were. And I see it in the way we think about this kind of work in many places. Like, how often do we do things kind of outsiders imposing ideas and will, like the missionaries or the nonprofits? We see it in hierarchical organizations, right? Things roll down from the top, corporate initiative after corporate initiative. The people themselves never get asked about what's needed. And as you can hear in the story, setting the context and showing up with the eyes that you believe they have it and that you're actually going to listen to what they say, it unleashes something, as you said, that wasn't there before, right? I mean, it was latent. Is that how you would see it?
Yeah, I would see it as latent. But the centuries of rule from the outside in whatever form it was, imposed rule, and then the years of the war had destroyed the capacity to really access it. Plus, it had fragmented the community fabric. And the Fumble Talk process, because it took 3 to 4 months to walk a village, they're not coming in and running these bonfire ceremonies for the village. They're actually inviting the village to lead the process themselves and facilitating that process. And that takes several months. So in the process, you're also reweaving the networks of the community, reweaving the fabric of that community. And then that community itself is like a living entity. It's an organism in and of itself. It's an actor in the process. And it has its own vitality and power. And so the bonfire ceremonies then became these places where, yes, people could acknowledge what happened in the war and apologize and forgive each other, but it was reclaiming the wholeness of the community. That was also the space within which it was safe to talk about what happened. And there was an implicit understanding that they're the people that will be there to help you deal with the results of this in an ongoing way. And so reclaiming that communal resource, understanding what it is, and repairing the container itself of the community, that is what then releases the potential so that people can really help themselves.
In my friendship and working, you know, over time with you and your John's organizations, that idea of seeing the container of the community as something, because I've seen a lot in the States, the way we work is so transactional. We're focused on the deliverable, like, are you going to get to this goal? Are we going to get 27 kids to score this? Are we going to make a profit? So we actually ignore the group process is secondary often, right, to our goal and getting through the goal, and then we're done with the goal and let's move on. But what I see in the way you all approach it is that the process itself of how you do the work together is the work in a way. Is that how you would see it? Like you're building the container is as important as the bonfire and that piece, you know, all the amazing things that come out of that truth telling and the rebuilding relationship. But the process seems to be also the point.
Yeah, the phrase that we use is the process is the product. And it's counterintuitive in the way a lot of humanitarian aid works. And it has its own implications about that. But just before I go into that, just that idea of the process is the product, the metaphor that we use is in the international aid arena, if you look at the community that's having the problem, as the metaphor that we use is that that's like a cup. And the aid that's coming in to address whatever challenge that community is having is like a bottle of water. And the aid community just comes in and pours the water into the cup to try to deal with the problem. But it flows right through because the cup itself is cracked. And the cup itself is invisible in the international aid community, in the humanitarian work, much less the work of repairing the cup. And if you just, you pour the water in, not the problem doesn't change, so you pour more water in, oftentimes all it does is actually makes the crack in the cup wider. It leaves the community worse off than it was before and more divided and fragmented, and it depletes the aid community, right? So FumbleTalk's work is not about pouring water in, it's about repairing the cup. And then to take the metaphor one step further, what we found is that when you repair the cup, obviously then it can hold water if there's aid that comes in from the outside, but it actually then becomes not just a container, but like a well. And it allows the community to tap into there's deep reserves of groundwater within the community itself that now once the cup is repaired, they can actually tap into their own reserves of water, of inspiration, of resource.
And I remember when I was at the gathering in Sierra Leone, the first day at the session, they had a lot of people from the different communities that you worked in had representatives who came, and they all showed up at the big platform outside the hotel in the morning on the deck. And I remember these women had little signs, like that metaphor of the cup is one that you used throughout the country. And it's such a beautiful, relatable one, even if you know, could just anyone can convey it so simply. And I remember them having signs saying, "Thank you, John Cocker and FumbleTalk. Our cup is now strong." It was lovely to see that. And then once something gets named, you can see it and you can all pay attention to it. And how would you see that, you know, because you live in the US, I mean, how do you see that relating to what some of the struggles we're having at the moment in our culture or the what might be the equivalent here?
I think oftentimes we don't pay attention to relationship, and we don't pay attention to even to the communities where we do live and work, much less the work of repairing and strengthening our communities. And we don't see that that's a resource. And a visible place where I've seen the potential in doing it is actually in schools and classrooms. So in a classroom, because those are places where we're with a group of people over time and you build a sense of community. And just to tell a specific story about that, when I spoke at a middle school in Philadelphia about FumbleTalk, and the students there were, you know, so impressed by what they had seen and experienced. And they had been plagued by all sorts of conflict all year long in their classes. And after I spoke, they had been out on a field trip and it had a fight break out. One student hit another student. And instead of running to tell the teacher, they gathered everybody and sat in a circle and talked it through and worked out the issues. And then the one little boy raised his hand. He's like, "Oh, we just had our own fumble talk."
I love it. I love it.
And they told their teachers about it. And the teachers then brought them in the classroom the next day and sat them all in a circle and just said, you know, enough is enough. We've had these problems all year. Let's have a fumble talk, our own bonfire process without the bonfire. And 2 hours later, everybody in the class had spoken. Almost everybody had cried. And what they had created was a space to address, you know, we come into these communal spaces and we're not just bringing ourselves as a student, somebody who's learning math or reading, right? We're bringing the rest of our lives with us. Yeah. And how do we interact with each other as people and not just as objects or as functions in whatever function we have? And creating space for that, to remember our humanity and to interact with each other as humans, is critical in creating learning environments, spaces where we want to do something together that helps all of us. Yeah. And so a space that acknowledges the communal dimension of it and the relational dimension and gives us some tools for just for acknowledging our humanness and dealing with it constructively, so important and powerful. And that's just an example of the kind of context where it becomes visible and powerful.
That's a great story. And in the first episode of the podcast with Nancy Gabriel, we talked about the value of circle as such a core space to create that's not that expensive or involved once you learn sitting in a circle with a few ground rules, and that the lack of that causes so much problem, you know, that we could add adding those spaces in. So that's a good segue for the next part of the story, which in these villages after the bonfire, and we'll have notes that link to the book and to some wonderful videos and details of all the details of the story. But after those, you started hearing from the women that they needed a space, back to this theme of part of what was so amazing in your story is you really paid attention to creating the spaces for community. So can you share a little more about what happened next for the women in the villages?
Yeah. I mean, in every fumble talk process, remember I had said that it took 3 to 4 months to prepare the village for that. In every fumble talk process, they were like helping to form committees at the community level to lead the process. And they made sure to have equal numbers of men and women. And they made sure to create spaces for the women, for the women's voices to be heard. So they wouldn't ask for their participation once or twice, but multiple times. So they were going to great lengths to bring women in into roles that they hadn't traditionally been in that culture. And still, the women said, we were uniquely hurt in the war and we need something more. And rather than just saying, but we're doing it in equitable ways, right? Fumble Talk heard that and said, okay. And what did they do? They brought the women together from the communities where they were already working to do a consultation on it. What do you need? And these women came together and they said, we just need a space to come together as women. And we want to heal from the war by working together for our communities. And we want to do that as women. And they said, we want to have this space, and they wanted to pick their own name, and they wanted not a political name. They're like, we want to be called the Peace Mothers. And so that structure then became part of what Fumble Talk would set up in every community where it worked, a Peace Mothers structure that invited the women together to lead, to come together. And they identified not like their own individual needs, but what their community needed and how they could come together and work on it. And what they said was, A, because it gave them a sense of empowerment and they were reclaiming their role as leaders and not just as victims. B, because as they were doing all of these things for their community, they would have the informal conversations with each other as women to talk about the things that they couldn't talk about with anybody else. And that was what they most needed, just time and space with other women to be resources for each other on the difficult things that even with their husbands, they couldn't talk about necessarily. And the Peace Mothers have unleashed incredible energy across the whole country. Like, again, being invited into leadership with and for each other and having a space in their community that they could step into as leaders, it just unleashed this incredible force. So they've built community centers. They have started farms. They've started micro enterprise to raise funds for sending children to school or building a health center. And then they've built all these local networks of trust. So whenever there's another crisis, those networks are there and the women can be mobilized to help educate and reach their communities about it, which is what happened in the Ebola crisis. It's what happened when there was election violence. These women were organized and they mobilized to prevent election violence. And so over the course of a couple now national elections, these local networks of mobilized, trusted women have been incredibly effective at preventing election violence in their communities and in responding to Ebola.
It's a beautiful story. And it reminds me when we were at the conference, one of the days of this five-day event, and this had people from all different countries at it, they organized for us to go out in little groups of people to different villages. And many of those were having Peace Mother gatherings in their village the day we went. And these were gatherings. It was all the women, but the whole village was there. Like the men were all there too. And it was such a profound experience to witness that. And we all then came back the next day and it was this lively discussion in this ballroom full of 100 people. Like, what did you see? What did you notice? And people were asking all these questions. And someone from Kenya stood up, I think it was Kenya, and they were saying, I've just been so impressed with the Sierra Leone people and the level of their motivation and the way the villages are pulling together and doing things. They're like, in my country, it's just much more like aid and people kind of waiting on handouts. And what is it about the Sierra Leone people that's so special? And I remember John laughing and saying, no. That's exactly how Sierra Leone people were after so many decades of colonialism and war and, you know, past histories. And it was the process of that accompaniment and the inviting for the leadership over the time that activated what you now see.
Yeah, I mean, it's what I was talking about, the legacy of thinking about aid as pouring water into a cup and it just continues to go through. Like, it just creates these cycles of dependency and people feel that they have to simply be present in their need and heighten the expression of their need in order to secure the aid from the outside. And so unlearning what John would call NGO complex. We had to unlearn NGO mentality. Like, it was just an educated process of dependence. And to say, we're not here to give you money, but you don't need us to. You have answers, you have resources, and we're going to see that and we're going to invite them forward and we're going to be here to help you animate and activate them. My sense is that that is a pattern and a process that is fairly universal. I mean, one of the things that I'm curious about is what are the ways, like for you in your work, have you seen that we've internalized these definitions of limitation that aren't necessarily true, but they have become part of the way we operate because it's like the system has pushed us into to thinking that that's the only way it has to be. Like, do you encounter that? And what does that look like for you in your arenas of work?
Well, one of the things I often do with groups is teach them to collaborate and co-create. And so often I come in using open questions like, how could it? What would it take to? And I see it in a lot of organizations as a compliance mentality. Like, if it's been top down and everyone's just, you're supposed to do what you're supposed to do and here's what you got to do, like they're not actually being invited to think creatively or to bring forth their good ideas, you know. And then if you have the fear-based, if you mess up, you're going to get fired. You know, you have a lot of that in an organization or a people, all that potential is just dormant. But if you set the context right and allow them the space to like think creatively and encourage that, but that's, I think, where like life coaches and some of the more mentorship, the organizational forms that are moving towards more hosting and partnership and stewarding leadership, I think it holds such promise because with the right conditions, all kinds of human creativity can happen. But I've seen it too. Of if you've been told for years, we don't pay you to think, right?
Yeah.
It's sometimes really hard for people even to think of the questions, you know, or think creatively because so it's the context around them that has suppressed that human quality. And I feel like we have a lot more possibility to create these kind of spaces for this, the spaces where we care about the community together. And when you do those, you sometimes have to really invite people into that because they're used to just focusing on their organization and their mission and they don't even see
repeatedly
the
cup, invite
right?
them.
Yeah. And to like, I say often, like, can you show up wearing two hats? Like, I know you have your organization hat and you're, we got to get funding for my organization hat. Right.
Yeah.
But can you show up and say, let's care about the ecosystem? and like put that organizational ego aside for a little while to like have a conversation about what the whole thing needs. So those are examples how I see it play out.
Yeah. And I love those examples, Beth, because what it illustrates to me is something that I've seen to be so important, which is when you are an outside facilitator or supporter and you're helping to create the spaces, like how are you envisioning them? Are you envisioning them as spaces of aid, or are you envisioning them as spaces of creativity? I think there's so much potential. If we could see the whole humanitarian system as one of how do we create spaces of creativity, co-creativity, and how can I, as an outsider, look at an aid or what the field is called international development? And I have my own set of problems with that word development, but if we can look at this as creating spaces of creativity. But one of the things that requires is not just a redefinition of like seeing the cup of the community and the work of rebuilding the cup, but it's actually a different role for the outsider, right? What does it ask of me if I am not about working in a one way, me to you, outside in way, but envisioning this as a space of co-creativity? And I have to come in completely differently. I have to come in from an orientation of seeing your potential, seeing your capacity, creating a space to invite it, listening for it, accompanying it, helping it to grow, learning from it. So bottom line, I have to come in as a learner, not as an expert, except in the process to help mobilize this, but as a learner. And I think that's where we need to reorient our international peace and development system to actually help those who want to support from outside of context learn how to come in as learners and accompaniers and co-creators in the process. It's just a different orientation.
Yeah. And again, to translate to many other contexts, not just the international aid one, but that I think is how we have to rethink, quote, leadership or how we organize. I mean, you can have the same thing of putting teachers and like in a school environment. How do we help the teachers and those like centered on the students create the most effective learning environment? And how can we accompany that as opposed to people who never work in the classroom rolling down requirements? Or the same thing, like in a community, you have all these nonprofits, but then you have the citizens themselves, people in neighborhoods, just like your villagers who for years have just been, have other people coming in saying, hey, we got something for you. Right. So it's that same process. As someone who's been a consultant and a facilitator coming in, sometimes quote from the outside or as the expert, I've spent a long time in that inner reorienting to say, how do I come in with questions? And I picture myself standing side by side with the person at their side, asking a question as we both look in front, like what's happening here? What do we need? What do you need? You know, so drawing forth and asking them good open questions. And I'm orienting from like, I don't know. I've seen other things to work, but you have the answers.
Right? But is that hard for you to go in explicitly as with that I don't know orientation? Like, what does it take to go in with that, to be willing to be present not knowing? Because I find that to be a place where all of the structures of, you know, that I learned how to do international relations, international peace building and conflict resolution, international development, like we're all really about cultivating my own expertise. And it's been a continual unlearning process.
Unlearning.
What supports your unlearning?
Yes, it has. For me, it has been because you're trained to have answers, right? And
right.
Hey, we're paying you this money. You come in with answers. So for me, I think getting the learning, the method of asking good questions, which really I learned pretty early on as I was working in starting a sustainability nonprofit. And we came upon that method. And so for many, many years, I've just been in the open question of how could we? And this quote, one of my teachers was Fran Peavy, and she said this quote that I've just always kept so central, which is it's a far superior strategy to get all minds working on what needs to change rather than trying to convince people that I have the best answer. Mm. And so I've always kept that very central and found that by asking the open questions and really trying to imagine that the people themselves have the answers, you know, like I've just found it to work so often, and that the feeling of the exchange, I'm not getting resistance as much. And so there's still times that I will advocate or I feel like my expertise is the process of how to hold it. So at times I will say, hey, we got to do it this way and this is why, right? But yeah. That part of really trying to interact with people and imagine that they have answers within them that they haven't even articulated before. And if I can really listen and reflect and mirror, and the way you talk about inviting forth their leadership and their knowing, I feel like it's magic. And the feeling of that man in the village who's like, no one ever showed up this way. That's something I just love, is I love interacting with people where they're like, wow, you're actually asking me and you're listening and you're not talking about yourself. You know, how quick people just come and talk about their own answers, right?
Yeah. And one of the things that I hear in what you're saying too, Beth, is an acknowledgement that we're not talking about just individual one-on-one things or like an individual action for improvement or an individual mindset even, but like the communal and the collective spaces that allow for and invite that. And one of the things, I mean, I can nerd out on all of the technical details of it. So at the risk of being a little too nerded out on that, I would just say, you know, for me, the way that we've done that in the Sierra Leone context is actually through what we call creating learning and immersion design spaces. So in other words, at every level, you create a learning circle. It isn't just going into a community and doing a bonfire. It's creating a structure in that community. At the local level, they're called reconciliation committees, outreach teams, and peace mothers groups. Those structures stay in place. And so that becomes a place where the community can have its collective decision-making process, can go when new problems arise, can assess, okay, it used to be that this was a problem. Now we addressed it. What's the next issue we want to address, right? So the spaces where you can come together and nurture collective action and collective decision-making and ongoing real-time discernment. And we've established those at every level. So at the organizational level, the Fumble Talk staff meets monthly to share learning from different areas, to address collective problems, to share what they're learning. And then we do that regularly at the international level also, to step back and reflect on where we are, what are we learning, and actually investing in those real-time learning spaces is critical. And it's another place where process is product, right? That's not a visible result, but more than anything else, if you have good communal discernment, decision-making spaces, reflection, it's what awakens, it's what enables people to bring their whole selves to the process. And it's what enables the process to be sustainable and adaptive and responsive. And people know what is needed. Yeah. Not necessarily individually, but when we come together with the right people in conversation, those things surface and you can trust that process is reliable and powerful. And I'm assuming that those same kind of, you might not use the phrase learning and immersion design spaces, but what else you might use to describe that kind of a living learning space that is what makes something open to imagination and creativity.
I resonate so much with that. And one of my experiences, often the way I find to work really well is to have, say you're doing work with a group, you have a design or a hosting team that's carrying forward a piece of work. So you're kind of, okay, what does the next meeting need to cover? What's the next phase of this project or initiative? And then you design it together with a lot of input and you arrive together at what is needed for that conversation. What are the right questions? And then you have it. And then after it, you have, we call it like the debrief for like what happened, you know, a little while later. And then the whole team's reflecting on what did you experience? What did you notice? What worked well? What didn't? What do we want to do for next time? And so I think what's so beautiful about it also is this experience of noting, what did we just create together? I think of it as collective efficacy. Like we talk a lot about the individual and what are you good at and what are your capacities, but this ability to build our collaborative muscles and our collective efficiency, effectiveness. So you actually all start to say, well, I liked that you did this or that worked better, or that's what we learned last time and let's keep doing that. And it's joyful. My favorite parts of collaborating is those pre and post debriefs. And I feel like we need to build a lot more of that in. It goes back to this overproductive, efficient, all right, we're done with that, move on, you know, right. And not pausing to say, wait, what just happened? What can we learn? Yeah.
And what's the role of the outsider in that? Because I think that's also really important. It isn't just somebody who's there holding a vision of what you're trying to accomplish, that you're working towards that a linear sort of objective mechanically, but it's actually the one who brings an outside eye, who's looking for the questions that are there, the answers that are there, who's inviting them forward. And I think one of the things that we've discovered over and over again is the critical role that an outsider can provide in seeing potential that people who are embedded in that situation don't see themselves. It's there, but they can't see it. You need the outsider to see it and invite it forward. And that outside eye that's proactively looking for the resources and the potential and learning how to do that as somebody coming in to support in whatever way is a critical skill. Learning how to see potential and invite it forward. And Lillian Morsay is the director of Peace Mothers in Sierra Leone. And she does this over and over and over. And it's kind of embedded into the Fumble Talk process. And one story in particular, we were actually in a village called Bondu, which was ground zero for Ebola. And they were just starting to rebuild after it. And we went and they were having a visit to organize the Peace Mothers. These women had walked there from 16 neighboring villages. And there was this young woman in the middle, her name was Fatim, who was speaking so powerfully and inviting them and organizing them and telling them about the larger purpose and the larger process and so articulate. And I was standing next to John. I turned to him and I was like, oh my gosh, you should snap her up for the Fumble Talk staff. I was thinking the same thing. Well, it turns out Lillian had seen her in the community in her work to help organize that process and had seen some potential and said, I want you to help organize this. And she like literally ran away into the house. She's like, no, I can't do it. I can't do it. Literally ran away. And Lillian had to invite her out. Yes, you can do it. And not just once or twice, but several times. And there she was. Yes, she could. And she needed to have that invitation and that encouragement. And we all need that, right?
We
all need that.
Yeah.
And so what are the spaces where we can open ourselves to what will encourage and invite us forward? And how can we make space within whatever initiatives we're doing for that outside eye, for that, the one who sees the potential, who invites it, who encourages it? What is it? Like if we can build in encouragement into our program design, like it can unleash so much potential that's there, but we have to acknowledge how powerful it is.
And maybe we can just switch it up because we're talking about things like nonprofits and program design, which not everyone is in that field, but I'd also love to flip it just back to the friendship level. So one of the things, particularly in the last 4 or 5 years, this idea of holding spaces for learning and like holding each other's journeys as we're in life. I feel like that's the kind of friendship you and I have been developing.
Yeah.
And I have that with several friends who are kindred spirits. Like we're interested in the same questions in life and in work. And then it's so fulfilling to just set some regular times to get together where we're kind of returning to some of the same questions we're holding. And like, what are you seeing? What are we seeing? Let's try a weekend where we experiment with some things. Like I have a couple friends, we have a standing weekly call on Zoom and we're all doing facilitation or one of our colleagues is a therapist, but we just hold a space once a week and whatever's up and moving, personal or professional, we explore it together, but it also is related back to a lot of the like the methods and the theories we're all into. So holding those learning spaces, it can speak to that in your life, like personal or professional.
Yeah. Well, for me, that's the intersection in a lot of ways of the personal and professional. And I would just say one dynamic there is, you know, I think we're at a time where the old ways of working just don't work anymore, right? And the new are still emerging. They're not totally clear. Like we are making them as we go. We're imagining them into being an expression. And I think when you are at the emerging edge of something, you're always moving into the unknown. It's impossible to be there alone. So I think developing relationships with others who are also at their learning edges is an incredible resource. They might not be doing it in the places or in the ways that you are, but this is the thing that I find, like in our friendship and in the gatherings that you and I have had with others, it's like just being with other people who are living and imagining into something new. It's like repairing my own little community cup.
Right.
Right. It unleashes this new you know, these incredible resources. And I had, I mean, the most dramatic example of that for me was at a certain point in my work with Fumble Talk, in fact, where I had just poured everything for about 6 or 7 years into that in terms of time, energy, heart, resources, and felt like I poured myself out. Lost myself in the process. And we were at a turning point, and I had no idea how to go forward, either as a person, as a leader, or organizationally. And I convened a few of these wise colleagues that I had, or people who knew me in different ways or worked together, and had what became, I ended up calling it my wisdom circle group. But, and it started at first, I was at a point of such depletion and not knowing that at first what I had to do was to have them hold a space with me in the middle. Like, I was always the one who was holding the space for others. Mm. I didn't have any space where it was held for me. And ultimately, it was so hard to hear people reflect on my strengths and capacities and uniquenesses. Like, I literally didn't have a muscle that allowed me to receive that. I had to develop that muscle. But ultimately, what I learned was, I found this group. It's a communal space, which I think is critical. There's something unique about a community, even than our closest one-on-one relationships.
I agree.
It becomes visible. And then what I learned is the humility that it took to receive from others. Like, I think sometimes my desire to always be the one who's giving comes from a place of guilt or of control or of these old patterns that just can only go so far. Mm-hmm. And unless we are open to receiving, well, I guess what I learned was ultimately, I can only give to the degree that I'm also willing and able to receive. And that was a profound learning for me. And it's been an ongoing invitation, because what I realize is actually there is so much more good available to and for me on my behalf than I even know to imagine or ask for. Mm. And it's one of the reasons why I love having other gatherings, like the ones that you and I have talked about or done, like where we've brought together small groups of people who are at the leading edge of their own learning. I find that to be so incredibly resourcing for me. It opens up new imagination for me of what is possible. And I think, like, there's a beautiful question, as David White would say, is like, how much good is available for each of us individually and communally if we were actually able to envision it and imagine it and receive it? And what would it take to receive the good that's available for each of us? To me, that's a question that love with a capital L is asking on our behalf.
That's a beautiful way to say it. Love with a capital L. I've used love with a capital L in thinking of the resource. We talk about resourcing each other, right? That I can be a resource to you at certain moments, you can resource me. And there's something in the interaction when we show up for each other, not knowing, asking the question, giving you space to just talk out loud in a way that where you just go on and on, you're not sure where it's going, and you're saying things out loud that you haven't ever said before. I mean, those spaces, they're magic. They are. They're so nourishing. And I feel there's a need to create a lot more of those as we think about what's missing right now, and that we could create those spaces. You had also mentioned in your story in Sierra Leone, you and John had to drive miles over very poor roads in your work. So can you say a little more about how just that unstructured drive time ended up being incredibly helpful?
Yeah. I mean, as much as I resisted it at one level, because first of all, the roads are really bumpy and it wasn't always physically comfortable to be driving that long in those difficult conditions. But, and also there's a part of me, the other way it was hard is I am accomplishment oriented, right? Like, I wanted to get stuff done. I thought the purpose of, if we're going to a community for a meeting, the purpose was the meeting, right? So let's get there so we can do the work of the day. But when it takes hours to get there, it's like, just get through the car ride to get there. But I began to see the ways in which John and I, on these hours that we would have together in the car, would just be able to have these rambling conversations. And they would circle around an issue that was a challenge that had come up or a vision or something that we'd been thinking about. And we would just circle around from problem to concept to dream to, and because we were the two that had the most sort of big picture view of the programming, like we could kind of dream together in ways that other people, you know, weren't necessarily in a position to do. The car rides became this incredibly rich time for the evolution where we supported each other as leaders and the evolution of the program, like where we could step back and reflect and like, would I have ever task-oriented me? Would I have ever built in, let's have a 5-hour conversation time that's unstructured.
Like, 5 hours.
No way. I can imagine John would have been like, ew, no.
No way. But precious time.
But it did. Yeah. So, you know, Car Talk was like, it was the space for a different kind of learning, a different kind of visioning, a different kind of growth. I mean, as part of what I describe as our learning and immersion design platform, but it's part of how I think sometimes it's the circling around that actually moves things forward, not the intentional time to move things forward. You have to stop. You have to go slow. Sometimes you have to do nothing in order to move things forward. And I think it was the relationship and the ideas that we grew in that the space of those conversations that ultimately has been, you know, such a part of the strength of the support for the program growing in the way that it has.
Yeah. I feel it often is the clarity arises out of that circling and out of, you know, you might then start talking about something you see on the side of the road or, you know, how's your daughter? Or, and then you come back to the problem, you go around, right? And
yeah,
we don't always get to it by focusing right at it. It's a different way.
In fact, I find more and more that focusing right at it actually makes it harder, right? And that's the thing I think about. So how do we build in this unstructured time
together
that is so needed? Together.
Time together, unstructured.
Yeah. And how do we value that? We make time and space for learning spaces as a structured part of all of our programming because it's critical, or retreat time. It's like you have to go slow to go fast.
Beautifully said. And that is a practice any of us could adopt personally and professionally in different ways. Yeah. So beautifully said. Well, I think we are coming to the end of our time. Thank you so much for your time today and all your wisdom and your lived example. And I'm really excited to invite people to check out your new book called The Answers Are There. And really been a pleasure dialoguing with you today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to have this chance. And I love the invitations that this conversation has given me. I'm grateful.
Great. Well, thank you.
I hope you'll join us in the next episode. It's all about the village and community. I'll be exploring the American experience and some stories of my own about individualism and mobility and thinking about how do those values we prize actually sometimes undermine our ability to form really strong, connected, caring communities. And then I'll be bringing in guest Kile Adimene. And she's originally from Nigeria, keeping our learning from African connections and experiences theme going, building on Sierra Leone. And Kile is someone who grew up in Nigeria and has lived in America for 20 years. So she's seen both cultures, and we get into a great conversation and learn about her work, working at the community scale, recreating the village experience that is in some cases lacking.
I think the idea here is to try to like recreate, bring that idea of a village living and living love and collective care back to life, be center in the front of what we do, because we do know, once we know when we have that support, when we feel connected, when we work together, there's all these phrases, together is stronger, all these things. And it's real, it takes a village. Our members is suffering. It takes a village to support that particular person.